ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
Welcome back from the diving expedition, Viv.
Well, look, I did try to live under the sea for a few weeks, Tim, but turns out that 30 metres below the surface, there's not a lot of media chat happening.
And you've been missing a lot of media chat. This week, the tech giants are climbing into Donald Trump's Tesla-branded clown car and having a good old whinge about Australia's regulations. So will it change what the government does next?
And trust in the media has declined to a point where even journalists are worried about it. What's going on and what needs to be done to restore it? But first up, Tim, do you ever look at the country's leaders or would-be leaders and think, gosh, I wish I knew a little bit less about their policy platforms and a little bit more about who they were friends with at high school?
Not only that, Viv, I also find myself thinking, I wish I knew what their dog walking habits are.
Well, that's very fortunate, Tim, because ahead of the looming federal election, both Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and wannabe Prime Minister, current opposition leader Peter Dutton, have been doing the rounds of podcasts. Both of them have been on Straight Talk with Mark Burris, who's a sort of prominent businessman, and then they've been doing different podcasts. Anthony Albanese went on It's a Lot with Abby Chatfield.
Abby Chatfield being the person who came to fame as a contestant in The Bachelor, if I remember correctly.
That's where she first came to prominence, yes, but I would say she's since built a platform far beyond being the person who came second on The Bachelor a number of years ago. She's got one of the most listened to podcasts in the country, and it's generally perceived that her audience are Greens voters who are women predominantly. Then both Peter Dutton and Anthony Albanese went on No Filter, a Mamma Mia podcast that used to be hosted by Mamma Mia's founder, Mia Friedman, and is now hosted by Kate Langbrook. And Mamma Mia put the podcasts out at the same time. Kate and Mamma Mia really framed that as,
soon Australian women will face a significant decision. In the coming weeks, they will help choose the next Prime Minister. Because our mission here at Mamma Mia is to make the world a better place for women and girls, we have invited both Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and the opposition leader Peter Dutton onto No Filter to speak directly to you.
That's how this whole podcast election is being framed.
Do you think either one of their performers would have changed any minds about what they stood for? That was the question for me, was we may have learned a little bit more about them as people. I'm not sure we learned that much more about their policies, but was that the point?
Well, the interview was meant to be, how are you, Peter Dutton, or how are you, Anthony Albanese, going to make the world a better place for women and girls? They touched on that policy platform, but largely I heard a lot of anecdotes about dog walking.
We both love the dog.
Toto.
And Toto's very spoilt, and Toto is certainly the first dog, and she knows it.
Friends from high school, their respective partners.
You walk with Kira Lee when you get the chance?
Yes, we do actually, yeah. It's not a substitute for date night, but it is a good time to spend some time together and, you know, just have a chat.
Albo's wedding plans, how he met his partner. So the criticism, I guess, heading into the 2025 election is that these podcast interviews are a bit too light, a bit too fluffy, and not really holding anyone accountable or throwing any difficult questions at them.
Now, is that us just being grumpy, gatekeeping journalists who believe that every interview should be highly confrontational, in which you demand the truth and bang the table?
Well, one of the criticisms of Abby Chatfield's interview with Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was that it was a total free kick for him. He wasn't challenged. Some people criticised her for being sycophantic to him. She came out in response and basically said, it's my podcast, it's my platform.
I also want to say that my primary goal in this is to get Labor back into government. If you're thinking this is so biased, it is biased.
I think some journalists or commentators felt like if you're gifted the opportunity to speak to one of the most powerful men in the country, you should do more with it. But she's not a journalist. She doesn't pretend to be. So I'm not sure that she could have held him accountable, because that's not her skill set. That's not what she does with her podcast.
And I suppose the maybe one point of difference with the Australian podcasts versus if we look back at the US election, where some people point towards Donald Trump going on the Joe Rogan podcast as a key moment, is I'm not sure any individual podcast has that same vote swinging influence.
Well, I guess we'll find out. They are trying to reach different audiences, younger audiences. And I think that's what the leaders are trying to do by going on these podcasts.
Yeah. Now, the new monthly podcast ranker was out this week. True Crime is ranking as well as ever in Australia's most popular podcasts. And let's hope that we don't hear from Mr. Dutton or Mr. Albanese in that genre.
We can only hope. But hey, Tim, there's been a big development late this week with the tech platforms Meta, Google, and Elon Musk's X asking US President Donald Trump to go after the Australian government.
Yes. So the thing which has kind of triggered the reaction this week is that Labor has a new policy, which I think is obvious now won't be legislated this side of the election. That's the newly badged news bargaining incentive. So effectively, that's going to be a levy on platforms like Google, Facebook, likely TikTok, could even be the AI companies. And they will be able to reduce the levy they would have to pay to the government by doing new deals with local news publishers instead.
It might seem a bit strange that this is what the Trump administration is focused on, but it has come about because Trump's Office of the United States Trade Representative wants to review and identify what it calls unfair trade practices and investigate harm from non-reciprocal trade agreements. So I guess you could look at this, though, and think, don't they have bigger battles to fight? Little old Australia here with its, you know, what it clearly thinks is a silly little tax or incentive. There's got to be bigger things. Why Australia? Why now?
I suspect history is the answer to that one. So if we look back to 2021, when the News Media Bargaining Code came along, you know, I must admit, many commentators, myself included at the time, thought, well, that will never work. And it did. And then we saw similar things adopted in New Zealand, in Canada, around the world. And all of a sudden, these platforms were suddenly having to effectively pay for the right to link to news, which they never had before. So they start getting nervous about precedents. And of course, yeah, the question is, does Australia then still have the ticker to go for this new piece of legislation? I had a quick answer back from a spokesperson for Michelle Rowland, the communications minister, just before we recorded this. And they told me, our digital policies apply equally to all companies operating in Australia, regardless of which country they're based in. We will continue to stand up for Australia's interests.
I note the word equally in there, which seems to be a direct response to the CCIA's allegation that our policies are discriminatory. So I guess they've thrown that in there to be like, we're not discriminating, we are equally implementing this. But beyond that, the comment doesn't tell me a lot about the government's intention heading into an election and a potential trade war with Trump over this.
Viv, I think this battle is only just getting underway.
Next, the crisis of lost trust in the media and how to restore it.
You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
How much do you trust the media? If you think the media isn't all that trustworthy, then you're actually with the majority of Australians. This week, the Edelman Trust Barometer, which is conducted all around the world, put out its latest findings. Now, some of the numbers in that, and these are produced by global PR firm Edelman, suggest that 37% of Aussies say they trust the media to do what's right. And that's down from 40% last year. And here's another stat, 69% of Australians agree with this statement. It is becoming harder to tell if news is from respected media or an individual trying to deceive people. And 70% of people worry that journalists are purposely misleading people by lying or exaggerating. And that's way up from 59% back in 2021.
And it seems like audiences aren't the only ones grappling with this. Journalists are having seemingly a similarly existential crisis. The latest survey by media services firm Medianet found a clear majority of journos think trust in the media is declining and they feel it's a cause for concern. So how did we get here? What's this state of distrust doing to our society? And how might the media win these audiences back?
Well, Terry Flew is a professor of digital communication and culture at the Media and Communications Department of the University of Sydney. And he's also a leading researcher in trust in media specifically. And he also hosts the Time for Trust podcast. Terry, welcome along.
Hello, Tim. Hello, Vivian.
Terry, you were at the launch for the Edelman Trust Barometer. What were your major takeaways from the findings?
Well, with regards to trust in the media, what's very striking with Australia is that trust in the media is lower than trust in business, trust in government, trust in NGOs. It continues to decline and it's very low by international standards. So while there is a general decline in trust in media, at least in traditional media, it seems to be more marked in Australia than elsewhere.
Why would that be, Terry? What is it in our culture, in our makeup, in our thought processes that seems to lend itself to that skepticism with media?
Well, it's interesting because it's not just a trust in traditional media, it's also a distrust in social media and increasing distrust in search engines, interestingly. And the highest levels of distrust are among those also identified as having a high level of grievance, which is to say a perception that society's institutions are not serving them. But again, in the Australian case, why is this? It could be an element of the concentrated media environment. It could be a perception of greater partisanship among some of the leading flagships. It could also be the relative lack of diversity and the only very limited emergence of new voices that we've seen from, you know, over a decade of development of digital-only platforms.
Well, yeah. I might ask you to build on that point a little bit, if you could, Terry, around the lack of diversity. Because obviously, in the days of newspapers, the criticism of Australia would often be dominated by the Murdoch press. Surely that's not still the case.
Well, the newspapers continue to have a disproportionate influence on other media. So in terms of agenda setting, having influential, particularly national newspapers, continues to have sway. That said, you're right, the capacity to influence, for example, voting patterns through newspapers is not nearly what it was 20 or 30 years ago. At the same time, I think there is a sense that there's a perception that fact and opinion have become blurred. And there's also a perception that journalists may be making themselves the story. Those two criticisms have been emerging quite consistently in studies of trust in Australian media.
Terry, earlier in this episode of Media Land, we explored the Leader of the Opposition and the Prime Minister going on podcasts with non-journalists and the criticisms that people have had of that strategy and of the questions being asked by the hosts. Has that muddied the waters with non-journalist content creators putting out information? Does it make news reporting less accurate than it used to be?
I don't think the political softball interview is a new thing. That, you know, historically politicians have often had preferred journalists or preferred media outlets. And I think podcasts are in a tradition of, say, political leaders will present themselves quite differently in women's magazines to how they would appear on Insiders or the 7:30 Report. So I don't think that's new. I think podcasting is a new vehicle for it. And I think podcasting is reshaping particularly the audio landscape in the same way as streaming is reshaping the television landscape. And we do have fewer viewers for the traditional outlets of investigative journalism, the 7:30 Report, Insiders, Four Corners, etc. And the commercial media have largely walked away from the kind of program that used to do this sort of work. So if you went back a couple of decades, the Sunday program.
I miss Laurie Oakes. I really miss Laurie Oakes.
No, it was seen as a big deal to prepare for Sunday in the same way as it might be seen that way for insiders now. But commercial television has largely walked away from that, other than breakfast television, which does have some influence. And the traditional newspapers are certainly feeling the resource squeeze and the number of people they can commit to political reporting.
Terry, one thing that has changed in recent years is obviously the advent of digital, and journalists identified a lot of those factors in the MediaNet survey. They identified clickbait, deliberate divisiveness, sensationalism as a problem that's impacting people's trust in them, plus social media amplifying misinformation, disinformation, and creating echo chambers, plus the sort of digital tendency not to provide adequate context and nuance, leading to a distorted understanding of complex issues. Do you think the media has done anything to deserve this lack of trust in audiences? Are they to blame at all for the current state of play?
The journalism industry is to blame, but I wouldn't want to put that on individual journalists, because they're under enormous pressure now to be seen to maximise page views and clicks and so on, produce a certain number of stories in a certain time. There's a lot of pressures in the newsroom and operating across multi-platform environments that are making it difficult to do the kind of deep dive journalism that might be sought. There was a period, certainly in the US about 6 or 7 years ago, where outlets such as The Atlantic, for instance, or indeed the Washington Post, were investing significantly in more in-depth journalism on the perception that they had a niche but influential niche audience that was seeking that sort of content. That seems to have dissipated in the mid-2020s, although it does strike me that there is potentially a gap for that kind of journalism, but the outlets that have sought to do it, like The Monthly, for instance, are not really thriving. So there is often in these surveys a gap between what people say that they want and what they actually will pay for.
Everybody says they want salad until they have chocolate put in front of them.
That's right.
My experience, anyway.
Everyone says they watch Four Corners and they're watching Married at First Sight. You know, there's a lot of that out there.
Now, another thing from the MediaNet survey that struck me as a really interesting statistic was that many journalists actually acknowledge or believe that their own reporting has bias and maybe don't see anything wrong with that. So something like 22% of journalists surveyed admitted to that. How does that strike you about how journalists see their own role? Is that changing?
Well, I might correct the point about whether they see anything wrong with it. They see enough wrong with it to want to report it in a survey. Will they resign their jobs for it? Not necessarily. And I think that comes down to the diversity question, that if you leave one major news outlet, you might find yourself unemployable at the others. There's not a lot of choices out there. It is disheartening to have that sense that people are working to a particular corporate line, although I'd have to say again, the idea that particular news outlets have certain, if you like, biases, or if you want to put differently, tendencies, has been there for some time. If you think of the UK, a Telegraph reader is perceived as quite different to a Guardian reader. In the US, the New York Times would openly present itself as a liberal media newspaper, noting that liberal in the US means something different to Australia. So the idea that a publication has an editorial line is not new, but I think in the current environment, people who've trained in journalism are feeling like the number of outlets they have that can give them a sustainable living and pay the mortgage is fewer and fewer, and so hence are perhaps more inclined to toe the line than may previously have been the case.
Terry, a lot of these problems, both from the journalist's perspective and that of their audiences, is this idea of bias. But do you think social media algorithms have skewed our idea of what bias is? Are we just used to seeing our exact thoughts and our exact views online? And then when we see an actual balanced report that gives voice to the other side, that's different for us now. And so we might mistakenly think that's biased or it's got an agenda, when actually it's just the media and journalists exposing us to different worldviews.
Yeah, in the academic literature, this is known as the filter bubbles debate, and it's quite a complex one. There are those who've argued that there are not filter bubbles because in practice most people go to a wide range of outlets across a range of ideological or political perspectives. At the same time, and this is the complicated bit, it doesn't appear as though that changes their perceptions of anything, and reinforcement effects, in fact, can work by going to other media in order to confirm that that media is biased or simply incorrect. So, yes, there are certainly algorithmic skews that are pulling in certain directions. Whether politics is the primary driver of it or whether it's a cluster of things is there. So, studies of the last US presidential election have found a very marked gender divide among young people now in terms of whether they voted for Donald Trump or Kamala Harris or vote Republican or Democrat. So these algorithmic points may sit within a wider constellation of factors that are reinforced through social media algorithms.
And I think it's a great point you make around the differences in different age groups as well. You know, that also came through in the trust survey. You mentioned this crisis of grievance when it comes to distrust in institutions, definitely skews younger as well. I'd love to talk about solutions, but what happens if we don't correct or find a way of reversing this distrust in media?
Well, there is an expectation of an informational baseline. So a diversity of opinions, which is a valuable thing in a democratic society, has historically been expected to sit upon an informational baseline that is shared. So, you know, we can have our opinions, but the facts are the facts. That has proved to be difficult to sustain, partly because of partisan mischief-making and alternative facts and so forth, partly also because there is a greater degree of contestation of expertise. So, I mean, we feel this in universities in ways not dissimilar to the way that journalists are feeling it. But the absence of an informational baseline actually makes it very difficult for a democracy to work. The absence of trust makes reforming political change difficult, that it's difficult to get consensus on issues. It can also impact upon the preparedness of citizens to comply with governments in times of need. And it can also produce a degree of political gridlock. And those three things are seen as problems. And they can ultimately be barriers to innovation because the business world looks to a degree of certainty in the political environment, and if you have this perpetual gridlock and lack of agreement on anything and an inability to get reforms going, that challenges the claims of democratic societies to work more effectively than authoritarian societies. So there is a link between a crisis of trust in the media and a potential crisis of democracy.
So how could media organisations work together to turn this around?
Well, there are provisions in journalism that should be addressing these things, such as code of ethics. I think that there's long been a criticism of self-regulation through the Press Council of Australia, and without re-prosecuting those issues, there is a sense that accountability is difficult to get, and there's the lack of third-party assurance of accountability, but I'm also aware that politically that is very difficult to change. I think that declaration of interests is important. Being able to demarcate news and opinion is important. At the same time, I'm aware that a certain type of crusading journalism has been there for a very long time, that there will be banner headlines that are designed to draw people to your outlet. And that's difficult to change. I think the marketplace can address it to some degree, that I think in Australia there is a notable gap for a kind of upmarket publication that's broadly of the centre-left, if you like, a sort of media equivalent to the Teals in politics. But whether that would prove to be financially viable is hard to know. It's also the case that any media that is subscription-based is going to be reaching at best about 20% of the population. So you're going to need safeguards around the media that reach the majority of the population, whether that is outlets such as the ABC or possibly government-supported commercial businesses. You were talking about the news media bargaining initiative earlier. I think that is in some crisis and was probably eventually going to be in some crisis. So there is the question of whether there will be direct government support to media outlets for public interest journalism or possibly alternatives. One that in a submission we put forward was a digital advertising levy that could equally apply to distributors from all countries. So yes, it would tax Google and Meta, but it would also tax outlets such as realestate.com and Domain. So that's an option to consider. I think also the just generally journalists need a greater degree of confidence in pursuing their business, and that is hard in newsrooms. That whatever you'd say about old-style media moguls, they were kind of driven by an interest in the media business, but where it's primarily a sort of content farming exercise that is under threat of being replaced by AI, these are very demoralising environments for many journalists to work in.
Terry Flew, a leading researcher in trust in media at the University of Sydney, thank you very much for joining us on Medialand.
Thank you.
Tim, any other business before we wrap up?
Well, scoop this week from friend of the show. I think we can call him that, having sat in for you a couple of times while you were off diving. Dani Saeed at Crikey. Malcolm Turnbull's campaign for a royal commission into the journalism of News Corp has finally died.
Was it ever really going to happen, though? I feel like this is part of that trend where politicians leave the top office in the land and then suddenly become very idealistic and inspired and want all these changes to happen.
Yeah, that's a very good point, particularly when it comes to the influence of the press, which we've been talking about already today, obviously, in Australia. When the press can do something for them, the politicians aren't as interested in going to war with them. And then afterwards, they decide that something needs to be done. We've seen the pattern with former Labour Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. We've seen the pattern with former Coalition Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. I think the last time I can remember a party actually seriously challenging the influence of News Corp while still in power was when Stephen Conroy was communications media in 2000, when Stephen Conroy was communications minister in 2011, and that inquiry in the end didn't really get anywhere.
Well, Malcolm Turnbull says that this royal commission is dead, although it does seem like it's a bit of semantics. It's changing hands from Australians for a Murdoch Royal Commission, which Turnbull co-chaired, to the Australia Institute. So perhaps it's just a bit of kicking the can down the road at the moment.
I think the conversation will continue.
If you want to get in touch, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
And remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app. Thanks to our producer, Nat Tenchich. We'll catch you the same time next week in your feeds and on Radio National.
See you, Tim.
Toodle-pip, Viv.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.